Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alan Essig, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the GOP's very unpopular tax legislation's long-term impact on working families and rising economic inequality in the U.S. Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, who examines how the FCC's repeal of net neutrality rules endangers internet freedom and the fight ahead to restore net neutrality protections. And Beatrice Codiani of the group Sex Workers and Allies Network and Brett Davidson of the Connecticut Bail Fund, who spoke at the recent International Data and Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights activists are putting pressure on Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to cancel a $12 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia, equipping vehicles with machine guns and anti-tank cannons. Trudeau explained that his government is only honoring the arms deal, which was negotiated by his predecessor, former Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Human rights monitors told Al Jazeera Canadian weapons have been used in atrocities committed by the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, as well as against dissidents in the kingdom's eastern Katif region. Amnesty International opposes all arms sales to Saudi Arabia due to persistent human rights violations in Yemen. Canada is the second largest arms supplier to Saudi Arabia, behind the United States. Saudi Arabia's powerful crown prince, 32-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, has pursued the war against Houthi rebels in Yemen and is countering Iranian influence elsewhere. In Canada, constitutional law professor Daniel Terp filed a lawsuit to stop the Saudi arms sale. The suit claims the arms deal violates Canadian export law and the Geneva Conventions. At the One Planet Summit, hosted by French President Emmanuel Macron, the World Bank pledged to stop making loans supporting oil and gas exploration in developing nations beginning in 2019. The new policy is part of a broader World Bank commitment to implement the Paris Climate Accord. The global financial institution will also report on greenhouse gas emissions produced by energy projects it finances. At the same time, the World Bank announced a $1 trillion investment in developing clean energy sources, including renewables, efficiency, and public transit, to meet commitments made in the Paris Climate Accord. $650 million to build 13 solar energy plants in Egypt are among the projects which will be funded. The Bank of England's governor announced that there is growing support for transparency among big banks and corporations, revealing their exposure to climate change risks in order to promote the development of a low-carbon economy. The initiative is supported by major UK banks, including Lloyds, Barclays, and the Royal Bank of Scotland. Across California, 30% of tenants pay half their income in rent and utilities, triple the costs during the boom times of the 1960s. Over the last decade, construction of affordable housing in California has trailed far behind job and population growth. As a result, the United Way of Greater Los Angeles expects a dramatic rise in the region's homeless population. Rent increases in places like San Francisco and Boston have led to new demands for rent control and tenants' rights. Housing activists in San Jose have waged a hunger strike that successfully pressured the city to adopt the nation's toughest rent regulations. New York recently became the first major city to pay for lawyers to assist tenants fighting evictions. Over the last few years, housing activism has expanded across the country, a trend that transcends the issue of rent control through its focus on halting gentrification and protecting low-income people of color from displacement. Isaac Simon Hodes of the group United for Change in Lynn, Massachusetts, told In These Times magazine that all these battles are part of the broader struggle to defend the human right to housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
With House and Senate passage of a final version of the Republican tax reform bill almost a certainty, Donald Trump and GOP legislators are about to get their first major legislative win since the 2016 election. But in the long run, that partisan victory will be felt as a net loss for millions of Americans. The tax reform bill will permanently lower the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. Businesses will be taxed at a lower rate than the majority of Americans who are wage earners. For individuals, the top income tax rate will be reduced to 37% from its current level of 39.6%. The super wealthy will also see benefits from reductions in the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax. Analysis by the Tax Policy Center finds that in 2018, working families will see some modest reductions in their taxes. But overall, the benefits of the new tax law will be concentrated among the wealthiest sector, with nearly two-thirds of the benefits going to the richest one-fifth of Americans. Because the individual tax cuts are temporary, by the year 2027, 53% of all Americans will pay more in taxes under the GOP tax bill. That year, 82.8% of the bill's benefits will go to the top 1%. Many observers believe the tax bill, which will add $1.46 trillion to the national debt over the next decade, will be used by the GOP to justify major cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the Republican tax bill's inclusion of a provision to eliminate the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate will result in 13 million Americans losing their health insurance coverage and higher premiums overall. Your reporter spoke with Alan Essig, executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the GOP's very unpopular tax plan's long-term impact on working families and rising economic inequality in the U.S.
It's basically a Christmas gift to the most profitable corporations and the wealthiest Americans. It is a bill that has been written for and geared towards and most benefit towards that group. There are individual tax cuts included in this also. The individual tax cuts as a share are much smaller than the tax cuts that go to businesses and to the wealthy. The individual tax cuts actually are temporary. They phase out and go away in 2025, while the corporate tax cuts are permanent. As unfair as the bill is when it's first implemented in 2018, 2019, it gets worse over time. It cuts the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. It cuts the top income tax rate from a little over 39% to 37%. By 2027, 10 years from now, it actually raises taxes on the bottom 60% of taxpayers. You know, it does not simplify the tax code at all. It actually makes it much more complicated. It is a accountant and lawyer bill. If there's one sector of the economy that's going to do really well, it's going to be tax lawyers and accountants to try to figure out what this does and to take advantage of all the, you know, not only the existing loopholes that they kept, but the new loopholes that they brought in. Again, as a whole, it is something that does not necessarily benefit the middle class. You know, if you look at the middle 20%, which we consider actually the middle class, in 2019, they will get on average about an $800 tax cut, while the richest 1% will get a tax cut of over $55,000. And it's not just, you know, some folks say that, well, you know, the wealthy pay more, so of course they will have more dollar amount. But it's not just the increased dollar amount they're getting; it's as a share of their income, they're getting a bigger break than anybody else.
Tell us how this tax bill will affect already record income inequality in the United States as compared to the rest of the industrialized world.
Oh, it'll just make it worse. The overwhelming benefits of this are to the top 1%, the top 5%. You know, right now, the income inequality has gotten considerably worse over the last 40 years. This is something that will make it even more unequal. There'll be more money flowing to the top, less money floating below. The estimated wage increases that the administration talks about is a fantasy. Anyone who's looked at it, any economist, any other group, the benefits clearly flow to the top. which again will just make a bad inequality situation even worse.
If, as expected, this tax bill passes and it's signed into law by President Trump, how can the Democrats, if they retake control of Congress and the White House over the next 4 years, repeal the Trump GOP tax cuts? Is it pretty easy to undo these tax cuts and to revisit changes in the tax code that would truly benefit people in the middle and among working families, something that this current legislation really does not do?
For the Democrats to do it, they would need to control both houses of Congress and the White House, because obviously any one Republican control can veto it, can stand in the way of doing rational tax policy. I mean, the ideal thing would be if the Democrats were in control is to truly do a bipartisan fix to this, to truly simplify our tax code, to get rid of the corporate loopholes that are in and that this bill makes even worse, to really gear the tax code to the benefit of low, moderate, middle-income folks. You know, it may be my Mr. Smith goes to Washington view of things, but I do think that it's possible. But it would take a truly bipartisan effort to do that, to really put the focus on the middle class, on low, moderate income folks. But, it needs to be done for the right reasons, for the right economic reasons, for the right tax policy reasons, and not just for pure political reasons to pay off those donors who donate money to the political class. I think that's possible to do, but is it easy? No. But I think it's a worthy goal to have.
That was Alan Essig, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Learn more about the GOP tax bill's impact on rising economic inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As expected, the Federal Communications Commission voted along party lines on December 14th to repeal the nation's net neutrality rules. Those rules, since their ratification in 2015, had prevented internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from engaging in censorship or controlling what consumers see and do on the web by slowing down or denying access to specific websites, apps, and other online services. The absence of regulation under net neutrality will now allow broadband providers to charge customers for paid prioritization, which could transform the internet into something that looks more like cable television, where consumers would be charged additional fees to gain access to certain websites at faster speeds. Before the FCC voted to eliminate net neutrality, nationwide protests were organized on December 7th. Now, after the vote, public interest groups and state attorneys generals are preparing lawsuits pushing for the restoration of net neutrality rules. And a campaign is gearing up to pressure Congress to overturn the FCC vote by passing a resolution of disapproval that would undo the FCC's dismantling of net neutrality rules. Your reporter spoke with Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Here, Picard examines how the repeal of net neutrality rules endangers internet freedom and the difficult fight ahead to restore net neutrality protections.
Well, I think it's going to affect us quite dramatically. At least, it may seem subtle at first, but what the FCC essentially did was entirely throw out the net neutrality protections that were put in place in 2015. But these protections prevented our internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast from interfering with our online content, from slowing it down, blocking it, or setting up fast and slow lanes where they prioritize certain kinds of content over others and force content creators to pay up. This is radically changing the underlying logic of the internet. And without sounding too melodramatic, it really is a blow to democracy. It's going to affect us in economic ways. It'll affect us as consumers of the internet. But I think most important, it's really going to affect the way that we can express ourselves creatively and politically online. So I don't think we can really exaggerate how profound of a change that will be if this goes through. And it, at least initially, it will go through in January.
So, Victor, who are the big beneficiaries of this repeal of net neutrality? Who are the ones
making the phone calls and visiting the offices of FCC commissioners and taking FCC Chair Ajit Pai out to lunch to push for these changes?
Yes. Part of the question we can only speculate, although I'm sure some of it is in the public record. But certainly, by all appearances, Ajit Pai is doing the work of these telecommunication companies. And really, I think no matter how you look at this, the only beneficiaries of losing net neutrality are those internet service monopolies like Verizon and Comcast. And of course, Ajit Pai used to work for Verizon. Some people suggest he thinks that he still does, even as FCC chair. But one way of describing this, it sounds like a very academic concept, but it's pretty straightforward, which is this idea of regulatory capture. And that's when you have a regulatory agency like the FCC that begins to harmonize its actions. Essentially, it internalizes the logics and the value systems of the industries that it purportedly regulates. And I think what we see with the FCC today is a textbook case of regulatory capture, not just with net neutrality, but almost every decision they've made in the last 10 months has been a longstanding wish for either telecommunication companies or broadcast companies. So it really does seem like the FCC is just doing customer service for these industries.
Just a question about Congress. You can give us your own view on where lawsuits might take this fight. But maybe a more realistic approach is trying to get Congress to overturn this repeal, given that there is bipartisan support for net neutrality. Do you have any feelings about where this may go? Is the House and Senate leadership diametrically opposed to net neutrality? Is there some opening there, you think, where enough public pressure could create results?
I think there is an opening, and I do think that's probably the most immediate thing that we as engaged citizens can really get involved, is to try to call our members of Congress, because you know it might be a pretty big hill to climb to get enough votes to pass this Congressional Review Act, but it's certainly worth a shot. And I think it goes without saying that the more pressure that we apply now, the more momentum we get on this, it's only going to help in the long run. I think it's also putting members of Congress on notice that voters are going to remember this in a short, 11 or so months away in the midterm elections. People are going to be voting on these kinds of issues. And you even saw some Republican members towards the end getting close to the FCC decision who wrote letters, signed letters, saying that the FCC should delay the vote or even decide to keep net neutrality. So we started to see a bit of, some sway on this. And I do think if the public maintains pressure, we could see real dividends here. Even, if we don't ultimately succeed, this is going to be a long-term struggle. And I actually would say with the courts, I would say I've heard very smart people who know our legal system and the law much better than I do, who say that we have at least 50-50 odds in the courts. So, I think we have a good shot with the courts as well. Yeah, I'm always pleasantly surprised that even though, again, it sounds so wonky when you say net neutrality, but people get it within seconds of the conversation. I mean, I think, probably a better way of framing it and describing it is calling it about, this is all about the open internet. But this ongoing fight about net neutrality is as important as it is and will remain so for the foreseeable future. I think it also underscores the need for creating truly public alternatives. This idea that, we just can't rely on these commercial providers and that we should be taking at least sectors of the internet out of the market. We should try to create these public structural alternatives like community or municipal owned and operated broadband networks. So we're not constantly fighting with these internet monopolies. And I think that's something that's an exciting area that I'm actually optimistic about, although that's also going to be a huge fight in the coming years.
That was Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy. Connect with national groups fighting to restore net neutrality by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers was observed this year on December 17th in cities here in the U.S. and around the world. A group in New Haven, Connecticut, calling themselves Sex Workers and Allies Network, or SWAN, held a rally in March in solidarity with sex workers and to mourn the many women and some men who have died or been murdered on the street. Those attending the rally also remembered two local women who disappeared and are now presumed dead. Beatrice Codiani co-founded SWAN and spends time almost every day walking New Haven streets to offer help and comfort to sex workers. SWAN members engage in daily outreach and harm reduction in the city, handing out winter clothes, clean needles, condoms, and naloxone, a medication that treats opioid overdoses. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven and recorded the speakers who addressed the gathering. We first hear from Beatrice Codiani, co-founder of SWAN, followed by Brett Davidson of the Connecticut Bail Fund.
At the end of October of last year, I happened to pick up my phone and on one of the news apps, I saw the faces of 14 women, and it says 14 women arrested in a prostitution sting, and it just really made me go bat crazy, because years ago I was strung out on heroin and I was out there on the street. And I know this, and I was in the closet about that for 50 years because I was so ashamed and so stigmatized. And here they were doing it to these women. But what really, really made me go batshit crazy was it said that this sting was a massive undercover operation. So I got in touch with the chief of police, and who claimed he didn't know anything about it. It was done under him, and he doesn't hear about these things. And, you know, so I told him a massive undercover operation. I mean, all that money, all those resources could have been gone to helping the women on the street instead of, you know, arresting them and stigmatizing not only them but their children. So he agreed to meet with Brett and I. The end result was that the chief of police called the stings off, which was really amazing because usually they don't do that. So then after that, Brett and I and other activists in the community got together and said, well, what are we going to do? I mean, we have to do more. So we, not knowing what we were doing, had got little goodie bags of things that people in this organization donated, with hats, gloves, scarves, hand warmers, a little personal item, you know, coffee cards to Dunkin' Donuts so that people can get off the street for a minute and keep warm. And we just walked down the street and we saw women and we told them about the rally we had. We invited them to it, but they didn't come. But then we just kept coming back and talking to the women. If you know somebody who's a sex worker, you know, please give them, you know, we had a card, and we had information about it. And gradually, the women started talking to us and pouring their hearts out. And we asked first, you know, what do you need? And every one of them said housing. And we couldn't supply that because, you know, we were broke. But we tried to, you know, we pass out condoms. We do needle exchange. We're a part now of the Greater Hartford Coalition for Harm Reduction. And they supply us with Narcan kits. And they came in handy for one of our members who overdosed. But the person she was with knew that she had a Narcan kit, and he saved her life. We're building up a reputation on the street of being a very useful organization among our members. So We also, I'm very proud to say that Swam was invited to George Soros Open Society Foundation for Sex Worker Summit. What we'd like is for the city to do something. We are just a grassroots organization making huge changes, building a coalition, getting trust and respect in this. This could have been done years ago, and it hasn't. So I don't want to talk too much. I know it's cold. And so I'm going to turn it over to Brett. Do you want to say about the Bail Fund?
Yeah, Brett.
It's not easy work coming out here every day because there's constant crises. People are out here dying, undergoing a lot of violence, all kinds of political violence, violence from people on the street. And Beatrice, often by herself, is there as the only witness and the only source of protection for a lot of people out here. So our whole community owes a huge debt of gratitude to Beatrice. And then a quick word about the way that the Connecticut Bail Fund has been able to work with Swan. One of the issues that sex workers in our community face is criminalization. And a lot of times sex workers are profiled by the police, targeted, arrested, if not for prostitution, for other charges, because the police are profiling them as sex workers just for standing on the street. And so we've been really honored to partner with Swan as the Bail Fund in order to bail people out so that we can make sure no one in our community is being incarcerated for doing sex work. We believe sex work should be completely decriminalized.
That was Brett Davidson, Executive Director of the Connecticut Bail Fund, preceded by Beatrice Codiani, co-founder of SWAN, the Sex Workers and Allies Network, both speaking at the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven, Connecticut on December 17th. Learn more about the growing sex workers' rights movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.